I'd like to thank everyone for joining us this evening for tonight's Torah for Tycoons class. So this is the second installment of season number 18 for Torah for Tycoons. We are in our Chai season. 18 years ago we began. I will just mention, because I think I see some friends of our Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser here this evening, that Phil Weiser was actually one of the founders of Torah for Tycoons, along with Mark Cooper. He was the one who had the idea to have a business ethics related a monthly class, which has over recent years kind of evolved into general ethics and current events ethics also quite a bit. And the news cycle, for better or for worse, has not failed to disappoint over the last few years, the last number of years, certainly. So we have all sorts of different topics, including tonight's, which we'll get to momentarily. I would also like to thank the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons. Really from its inception, if I'm not mistaken, from its inception, has been sponsored by the Harry H. Baron Trust. So thank you for that. And as always, I just want to mention the Kollel's Live on Life and Legacy program that we have, which is organized and offered here in Denver by Rose Community Foundation, helping the Kollel and a number of other Denver Jewish organizations create future financial stability through planned giving, wills, estate planning, and endowments. So if anyone is interested, it's not as scary as you think. And any amount that you would like to leave to create a legacy and leave a lasting impact and could really help the Kollel in the future, please feel free to shoot us an email at info@denverkollel.org. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce this evening's presenter, Scott Levin, who rejoins us from about a year ago. I'm actually just looking last year, September 2020, and so much has happened in the world and continues to happen in the world, Baruch Hashem, and so a lot has happened since then. But thank you, Scott, again for joining us and agreeing to present on this very relevant and timely topic. The other presenter, of course, is yours truly. I am Mordechai Fleischer, senior educator for the Denver Community Kollel. So without further ado, Scott, I just have to ask you to, okay, you just unmuted. There you go. So it's my pleasure to ask Scott to share with us his presentation this evening.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's I feel sort of like the host that's been invited back on Saturday Night Live. You know, for my fifth or sixth appearance at the Denver Kollel, it is really one of my pleasures, and especially to see friends, my colleague, Sue Parker Gerson, at least half of Judge Breeze that is going in and out of there. No, I'm joking. It is great. Look, we're a small group and most of us know each other, so I'm really hopeful that we'll be able to have real conversation here. I was really pleased when Rabbi asked me to talk about political correctness because it's something that bothers me. The term itself is often used as a cudgel to try and stop people from criticizing what's being said. Yet at the same time, I recognize that it can go to an extreme and that in extreme can have an impact. I pulled up just a definition from the Oxford Languages Dictionary that I thought just to get out on the table of political correctness. And it says it's a noun, the avoidance often considered as taken to extremes of forms of expression or action that are perceived to exclude, marginalize, or insult groups of people who are socially disadvantaged or discriminated against. And in my view, I think what you're looking at when people allege political correctness is happening, you're somewhere on this spectrum where on one end of it is cancel culture, which is the worst kind of attacks people can make to try to inhibit speech that's going on. And on the other end of that spectrum is this feeling that people have sometimes of a sense of loss, because all of a sudden they can no longer use the same kind of language that they used to use, and they feel somehow inhibited by it. My own perspective is that we have evolved as a society and we don't use, as we know, the same language that we used to use, especially to describe or insult marginalized or other groups that are out there. I often joke when I'm leading a workshop or speaking about our anti-bias work at the Anti-Defamation League that I can recall Shabbat dinners when I was growing up. And my grandfather and father would sometimes use language to describe people that you would have thought it was Archie Bunker, you know, from All in the Family, that was using that language. And today, just as we, you know, I'm sure at the time, some people felt a loss when they could no longer describe other people by some of the sort of nicknames, to put it in a positive light, but derogatory ones against people of color. And even in our own settings, again, growing up, you know, the use and description of Schwarzes, for instance, or Schicksals, or some of the other SH words that we have in our vocabulary, we just don't do that anymore in polite society. And again, some people might feel a sense of loss at not being able to do that. I personally don't think that that loss is worth recognizing, because I don't think that there's anything wrong for us all to appeal to our better angels. And I'm sure that the rabbi is going to talk about what the Talmud or the Torah has to say about that. But, you know, another thing that happens is that I've seen grow, not just people of color, but the way that we talk about women has changed over time, the way we act towards women. And all of that leads me to believe that the best standard that any of us can use is, if you're thinking that you're feeling a loss because you can't use certain language, or you're going to get chastised because it's politically correct, I'm sorry if this sounds misogynistic, but think about whether your daughter's in the room with you and whether or not you want to use that language in front of them. Oftentimes what we hear from people is that they're just joking and they don't mean anything by it. And not only are they just joking, but there might even be somebody from the targeted group that's there who doesn't object. And I think it's important to recognize that just joking doesn't give you a pass. And it's not up to you, the teller of the so-called joke, to decide whether or not it's funny. It's really up to the person who's the recipient or the target that gets to decide that. And oftentimes, just because they don't object doesn't mean that they're giving their affirmation that it's okay to do it. All too often, it's because there's a power differential that exists. Certainly, we understood that in the really, and have come to terms in some ways about that in the workplace, for instance, between men and women, where women did not always have the power to stand up to their boss to say that they didn't think it was funny or didn't appreciate the type of language that was being used. I think it's also just a couple more points I wanted to make is one of the things that Sue Parker Gerson and I are facing now on a nearly daily basis is Holocaust analogies that are being used primarily to try to score political points or justify positions as it relates to mask mandates or vaccine requirements or the requirement. I know I'm going to New York on Friday for a few days, and you have to show your vaccine card in order to get into restaurants and anywhere indoors and to shows and things like that. And as Sue knows, I've written a lot of letters to a lot of people asking them to stop doing it. I think it's not necessarily anti-Semitic. It can be. I don't mean to give it a pass, but oftentimes it's just political rhetoric that people are grabbing on the meme to try and justify their positions that are there. And I know that sometimes the response is, because we've seen at least one school board respond in this way, that, you know, we're trying to shut down speech, and we're by our so-called political correctness that's going on out there. And I don't think that that is really true. To us, the Holocaust is a singular event. It's the worst tragedy that's happened in the 20th century, if not over millennia, to have 6 million Jews and millions of others that are killed. Nothing really compares or should be analogized to the Holocaust other than the Holocaust. And so it's really demeaning to the memory of those people who are lost to equate it to somebody being asked to wear a mask or to show their vaccine card there. And in the same way, I ask that we who are Jewish need to also understand the offense that we take when people rely on the old tropes that are out there about Jews being cheap or controlling the media or controlling the banks or just controlling the world, or those kind of allegations that are made. And in the same way that we feel that offense, I think others do too. The final thing I want to tell you is that at the ADL, one of the things that we ask people to do, though, to sort of avoid that cancel culture, too woke kind of way of looking at things, is to recognize that everybody's on a journey. And so you need to assume, until proven otherwise, good intentions. And one way we do that, and what we teach to the kids in schools and in groups when we're working together with them, talking about these things, is sort of the concept of ouch and oops. And what I mean by that is that when somebody says something that is inappropriate, either targets you or targets other people, and you want to stand up against them, you don't necessarily just go cancel them, and you don't tell them what idiots they are, no matter whether you think that's justified or not. The easiest thing to do is say, ouch. That kind of is painful when I hear you talk that way. And give them the opportunity to say, oops, I made a mistake, or to move on. Because I think that so often, especially in my role at the ADL, I'm blessed with having a platform that I can sometimes bring public attention to things, but we spend a lot more time where we make the decision not to go public with it. A lot of this is just teachable moments. And again, yeah, believing that people are on a journey, giving them the opportunity to sort of have their own education around it. So again, I would encourage, although that's the topic that's tonight, I'd probably stay away myself from that term political correctness to describe what's going on. And instead, I think what I'd really, again, understand is that we all evolve and we're all on this journey. Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you very much, Scott. And before I start talking, because once I start talking, I don't stop that fast. If there are any questions or comments at this point, please feel free to unmute yourself and chime in before we proceed. Okay, easy crowd tonight, I guess. Okay, go ahead, Dan. Yeah.
Well, right. I don't want to go off a different tip. Scott, there are all different kinds of things I could say about this particular issue. I'm going to focus on one particular thing that you were sort of talking about people taking offense. I'm sure the rabbi was something about that. And what bothers or what's troubling or difficult is this subjective view of taking offense, which is if the other person takes offense, regardless of intent or the words or whatever, you have to somehow edit yourself or take note of it. And I understand it to a point, but the problem with taking someone's subjective response to something is that it's a version of the heckler's veto, or if the person takes offense, even if there's nothing offensive about it to a large portion of the population, it's ergo legitimate or it's okay, even though most people would say, why is that offensive? Why should the rest of society consider that offensive merely because you, one individual, might consider it to be offensive?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that's the reason I wouldn't support cancel culture, because that's what I think you're describing there a lot of. But on the other hand, I often think back to my 93 and 94 year old in-laws, who I was just recently having a conversation. I don't know if you all saw, but there's an actual board that's set up in the state of Colorado that's reviewing the names of the certain monuments and certain passes and different areas. And they're going to change the name Squaw Mountain that's up there. And the conversation, why would that be offensive to anybody? It's been that name for 150 years when nobody's objected to it before. And we've since learned, some of us have only recently learned, that squaw doesn't just mean Native American, but it means a diminutive feminine Indian. And we've been using that name to call all Indigenous people, male or female. So there are, some of it is a learning process of it. Some of it's an evolution. I think that the concern that you have, and it's, Dan, you raise a really good thing, is this, is the heckler's veto, because the loudest voices are the ones that are sometimes the most sensitive. On the other hand, and Sue, feel free to jump in on this. I have sort of a saying around the ADL, because, you know, we get complaints from people, constituents that write into us about things that they're offended by as Jews. And I like to recall that we're very sensitive people. And sometimes some of our co-religionists can be a bit too sensitive. Yet at the same time, there's a good reason why we're sensitive, because they've been trying to kill us for thousands of years. So trying to find out how to find those balances is always, always the challenge.
Okay. Anyone else before we proceed? Okay. So thank you, Danny. And thank you, Scott. I'm just going to share my screen. Give me a moment. And you should be able, is everyone able to see my sources over there at this point? Someone just confirmed you got it. Okay, thank you. All right. Okay. What I like to try to do, obviously in consonance with what Scott was discussing, is try to examine some of the points that he made, and that also, as Dan Garfield pointed out, also some of the points that he made, in terms of the Torah's view of our obligation to be sensitive to the feelings of others. How far does that go? And, you know, the question, of course, how far does that go? You know, is it ad infinitum? No matter what a person says, he or she finds offensive, does one have to be careful with that? And I also want to, hopefully we'll have time, as you can see, I have a bunch of sources here. But I would also like to try to discuss briefly exceptions where we don't take into account the sensitivities of others, and also whether there is room indeed for penalties, shall we call them, for those who are insensitive. Because certainly I think a lot of what we're seeing in what, as Scott referred to as cancel culture, is essentially people who are speaking, are saying something which others don't like. Very often when they're canceled, they might be, they might lose their job, or they might be ostracized, or things like that. Is that appropriate according to Torah law? Now, before I even start, as Scott was speaking, I realized that I had originally, when I put these sources together, had in mind to actually begin this whole conversation with a very important source, and I forgot to put it in. So I'm just going to speak it out before I actually begin going through the sources, and that is the famous dictum of Hillel. And I'm sure most, if not all of you, have heard of Hillel, the elder of Talmudic fame in the past, and the famed story of the would-be convert who came to Hillel and said, "Teach me the entirety of the Torah on one foot." And Hillel responded to him, "What you don't want done to you, do not do towards others." Okay. And that is really a measuring stick in terms of how do I figure out if I should be doing something to someone else? Well, how would I feel if it would be done to me? That is the question in terms of measuring whether something is appropriate or not. And the great late 19th century, early 20th century Jewish Torah leader, the Chofetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, of anti-Lashon Hara fame, he makes the point in his work on the laws of Lashon Hara of slander. He says, you can't measure it based on your personal preferences and habits. He gives the example and says, if you have a Torah scholar who studies 4 hours a day, let's just say he's studying in Kollel, and he's studying 4 hours a day, so that is coming up short. For someone to say, oh, this fellow, this Torah scholar, studies 4 hours of Torah a day, well, he's supposed to be doing it full time. So that would be Lashon Hara. That would be speaking negatively. Whereas a person who is working a 9-to-5 job, who studies Torah 4 hours a day, well, that's high praise. He's working a full day, and he finds 4 hours a day. You have to judge as if you were in that person's shoes, which is not always simple. But between Hillel and the Chofetz Chaim's expansion, really what we have to try to do is put the shoe on the other foot, you know, to bring it into more modern English terms of how would you feel, as Scott pointed out, how would you feel if the roles were reversed and someone was doing that to you? Okay, so that's something to keep in mind as we move through the different sources over here. The first source we have is a verse in Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. And that source says, a man shall not wrong his fellow, and you shall fear from your God. I am Hashem, your God. That is the verse. It's a pretty vague verse. What does it mean, you shall not wrong your fellow? So the word used over there is losonu. Okay, that word losonu, you shall not wrong, is the source for a word known as ona'a. Okay, there's two kinds of ona'a, says the Talmud. Just as there is ona'a, meaning wrongdoing, in buying and selling, meaning you're not allowed to rip off another person. You cannot overcharge if you are selling, or underpay if you are buying. You cannot deliberately, you cannot deliberately, knowingly overcharge, let's just say, a customer who doesn't know better for a product, or knowingly underpay a seller for a product when he thinks he's getting a fair deal. Okay, so just as that applies over there, there's also a wrongdoing with words. Okay, and the Talmud gives a couple of examples. One may not ask a would-be seller, how much does this item cost, but you're not interested in buying it at all, because you are getting the person's hopes up, and then you're dashing them knowingly. Can't do that. If a person is a Baal Teshuva, a person has repented for his past deeds, one may not say to him, remember your previous deeds. Remember when you used to do this. You're going to offend the person. If an individual is a descendant of converts, and he's perhaps sensitive about that, we have a proselyte to the Jewish people, one may not say to him, remember the deeds of your ancestors. Okay, again, we're obviously, in the context of where often, especially back in Talmudic times, proselytes were from idolaters who very often did not come from the best societies or customs and so on, that especially in those cases. But in a general sense, one has to be sensitive to others and has to watch what he says. The Talmud gives a lot more examples. Another example, just which I will point out, which is just worthwhile to point out, is the Talmud says that one should not be like Job's friends, who came to Job and tried to explain to him that the reason for his suffering must be because of his sins. Okay, if someone is going through a hard time, to go and say, well, you wouldn't be suffering if you didn't deserve it. You know, God must be punishing you for your misdeeds. It may or may not be true, but to say that to someone is wholly inappropriate. And that's just another example of the sensitivity a person has to have towards others. Okay, so those are two sources from the Torah, and then the expansion of the Talmud on this idea. There's actually a prohibition in the Torah against wronging others verbally, causing offense to others. Rashi takes this a step further, and this Rashi is an important Rashi, and he is commenting on a passage in the Talmud, which I did not include, just for brevity's and simplicity's sake. I'm just quoting Rashi's comment. Rashi says, therefore the verse says, the verse in source one over here, the verse concludes, and you shall fear from your God, for I am Hashem your God. So Rashi wonders, and again, it's really coming off the Talmud, why does the verse need to say you shall fear God? I mean, of course you should fear God. Why does it say it? Says Rashi, for all these things, okay, they're good or evil, and I apologize for that, there is misspelled, they're good or evil is not necessarily recognizable, except to the heart of the one doing it. And he can say, I only did this for good. So this really goes back to Scott's point earlier that we want to assume good intent when someone says something, and whether you're going to attack a person for saying something offensive or not. Well, very often that's the case. A person can say something and you can give that individual the benefit of the doubt that they didn't mean any offense and that they haven't really transgressed. To that end, the Torah says, since in theory you could say something offensive and no one's going to know about it but you, that only you know that you deliberately crossed that line. You deliberately offended someone and transgressed. Therefore, where you have situations where a person can transgress a prohibition in the Torah and no one but the person doing it is going to know the truth, so then it says you shall fear God. There is someone else who knows the truth, and that's the Almighty up above, and therefore you have to keep that in mind. Don't think you can get away with it. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. As Scott said, I was joking. I didn't mean it. You know, it was unintentional. But really, it was quite intentional. And, you know, and unfortunately, that does happen quite often. Well, a person will deliberately send a sharp barb someone else's way, a colleague's way, and then they'll say, oh, I was just joking. But he wasn't joking at all. He wasn't joking at all. And only that individual and God himself know the true intent. So another point which emerges from this Rashi is what Rashi seems to indicate is that you only transgress this if you are deliberately trying to cause offense. If a person puts his foot in his mouth by mistake, then seemingly he would not transgress this prohibition, okay, which would seem to be, okay, sorry, it was a mistake. I didn't really do anything wrong. Okay, we have a lot of prohibitions in the Torah where one can inadvertently transgress and one has to repent for that inadvertent transgression. But seemingly over here, the prohibition requires intent. If there's no intent, there's no transgression whatsoever. That is what it sounds like somewhat from Rashi. Before anyone takes that too far, let's see source number four. Okay. Source number four says as follows. One must be very careful that his words not contain even a hint of insult toward others, for the Torah is very particular with Onoas Devarim, for it is something very difficult. Again, I apologize for that glitch over there. That should say difficult. It's something very difficult for the hearts of people, and many people are more particular about it than they are about their money. How very true. That people are very, very particular about being insulted, about their self-esteem, about taking offense about things. And very often people are even more particular than they are about their money. Not always, but it's not unusual that people will not be upset. You know, if by mistake you rear-ended someone else's car, you know, okay, maybe you'll apologize and you'll exchange information and move on. But if you say something offensive during the exchange, so then you could be in a boatload of trouble, because then the person will take serious offense for it. And so here the Sefer Chinuch is telling us that even though technically speaking, a person can shoot off his mouth and not really think about it that much, say, well, I didn't intend to insult anyone. I wasn't trying to insult anyone. And he thinks he's off the hook because the Torah says it's only if you intend to offend someone else. But here the Sefer HaChinuch tells us, be very careful. Be very careful that your words not contain even a hint of insult toward others. So thought is necessary before you speak. Think before you speak. And that is a very good advice in general. Think not just once, twice, three times before you speak. If it's a particularly sensitive situation, think four, five, six times before you open your mouth. Is what I'm about to say appropriate? Will it cause offense to anyone? That is the idea being given to us over here by the Sefer HaChinuch. And that brings me to source five. And as Scott pointed out, maybe I'm going to apologize in advance for source five, that maybe in today's world, someone will be offended. But the Talmud says it, and as we will discuss a little bit later, if the Talmud says it, I am entitled to say it, even if someone is offended by it, perhaps. But here's the source. Rav said, one must be very careful with Onah of his wife, for her Onah is very close. The idea over here being put forth by the Talmud, and I am no marriage therapist by any stretch of the imagination, is that in a relationship of a husband-wife, the wife is very sensitive to how her husband speaks to her and relates to her and interacts with her. You know, again, today, probably the argument will be made that it's a two-way street. The men are just as sensitive to what the wife says as much as what the husband says about the wife, and so on. But the idea being put forth by the Talmud over here is an idea which really can be expanded upon. And that is, you have situations where you have to realize that there may be a greater degree of sensitivity than normal. The Talmud doesn't say, well, treat everyone with the equal degree of sensitivity. No. A husband vis-a-vis his wife has to be extra careful because she's extra sensitive. That would seem to indicate, and just to look quickly at source number six as well, one must be very careful with orphans and widows. Okay, how do we deal with them? Only speak softly to them, treat them only with respect. And that is Maimonides speaking. And he continues, this is a very brief quote, but anyone who pays attention to the weekly parsha, especially in the book of Shemos, in the book of Devarim, it will know that the Torah speaks many times about the sensitivity one must display towards orphans, towards widows, towards the disadvantaged, towards the poor, and, you know, towards those who don't have power, who don't have anyone to stand up for them. How careful one has to be. And so these sources, five and six, really bring this message home loud and clear. There is an idea of being extra sensitive to those who are in a less powerful position, who are disadvantaged, who are more sensitive, who have a more difficult lot in life. Okay, one has to be extra sensitive to those people. And I think we can certainly apply that to general society. You have to know whom you're dealing with. If you have a person who's had, let's just say, a difficult lot in life, you have a person who comes from a background, whatever it may be, again, without getting involved in all the politics of modern society, and everyone can draw their own conclusions. But when you have someone coming from a background or a community or a history of disadvantage, of suffering, one does have to be more sensitive in dealing with those individuals than one would regularly. So you can't just say, well, I could speak and, you know, when I speak to my friends, they don't have a problem with it, so I could say it to anyone. No, that is not the case. What's okay to say to your friend may not be okay, it's probably not okay, to say to one's spouse. What's okay to say to your friend may not be appropriate to say to an orphan or a widow or so on. And you have to know with whom you are dealing in any given situation and make sure that you are not causing offense because that person is more sensitive. Just to show another source, and then I'll stop for any questions. I'll just finish this section of my discussion up. Just how far this idea goes of causing offense. This source, again, may be somewhat offensive just in terms of graphic description. A person who expelled mucus from his nose and walks away, okay, meaning, I guess he didn't have a tissue, and he just kind of like cleared out his nose and left it, okay? That's obviously not a polite thing to do. What people tend to do today is leave their tissues on the table, the old synagogue gripe. Stop leaving your tissues on the table. Well, here you have a source. One who expelled mucus from his nose and leaves, and someone else comes and is repulsed. The one who expelled the mucus will come into judgment, for he causes disgust by his fellow. I mean, look at that. And also, if one brings his sons and daughters into his friend's home, and the way of small children is that their nasal area, I missed the word there, is repulsive, meaning kids tend to have runny noses. You know the picture. You know how it looks. He must clean them. And if not, he's punished, meaning you go to someone's house. What's expected, the next line is very important, but if a person comes to another's home and sees the children in such a state and is repulsed, he has not stumbled, for this is the normal way of children. What the Sefer Hasidim is telling us is, you've got to know what is expected and what's considered polite and appropriate and what's not. If I bring my kids to your house and they're messy and they have runny noses and it's just unpleasant, for me to walk into your home with my children that way is not appropriate. For me to leave my tissues on the table where other people are going to be repulsed by that is not appropriate. It's not okay. If you come to my house and my kids are a mess, you've walked into my house. If you walk into my house, as I always tell people when they walk into my house, ignore the mess, it's always this way. You know? And if you walk into my house, it's at your own risk. Okay? But the idea of how far this goes, we tend to think it's just common courtesy, politeness, and so on. But here the Sefer Hasidim tells us he'll be judged for that. You're responsible for causing someone else to be repulsed. Now, this is not emotional offense of the same type as calling someone a demeaning name or saying something that causes them, emotional distress because of their history or their family history or whatever it is. But the idea of how sensitive we have to be to the sensitivities of others, that even something which is considered impolite is not just, you know, part of what we call the overarching great Jewish mitzvah of be a mensch, but it's also included in this idea of wronging someone else, okay, is expressed here very, very nicely, if somewhat graphically, by the Sefer Hasidim. It doesn't translate well in the Hebrew. It's much, much more appropriate than it translates into the English. But these ideas, I think, kind of set the table for us in terms of the idea that, yes, the Torah does demand from us as Jews a very high level of sensitivity towards the feelings of others in a number of areas. And again, different people have different levels. We need to be sensitive to that. What causes them disgust? We need to be sensitive to that. So certainly the Torah does hold us to a high standard in terms of being sensitive to the needs of others. Now, I'll stop here for a moment if there are any questions or comments. And again, if you would like to, anyone want to weigh in, or Scott, if you have anything to add to the discussion, you know, from your point of view, please weigh in now, and then I'll continue.
I have a question. What about a situation where you know you're going to talk about a sensitive topic? I can't think of anything, a particular example right now where you say, look, I'm going to talk about the sensitive topic. It might be offensive to some people. Viewer discretion is advised. Whatever, right. You know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
What is that sort of have you sort of set the tone and say, hey, if you're going to be offended, I'm warning you now. Leave the room or whatever, and it's okay. I mean, obviously, it doesn't mean anything goes, but you might say some things that might be sensitive to some people. What's the situation there?
That's a fair question. And you are absolutely correct. As you're saying, as I'm thinking to myself that just about every podcast I listen to these days on Spotify say, this podcast may contain offensive material. And then there's like a whole laundry list of different things. Listener discretion is advised. And that just has become the standard disclaimer because of exactly what you're describing. I think as follows, there are two points I think I can make, two different points. One is, what if you have a general audience that will not take offense, but you might have one or two individuals who will take offense? So I don't recall where I saw this right now during my research for this class, but I did see somewhere one source seemed to say that if you have a large audience and there might be one or two people who will be offended, that's not necessarily your problem in the context of that large audience. Okay. I do want to contradistinct that with where a person will be embarrassed in front of the public. Let's just say I am speaking to a large audience and I'm going to call one person out in the audience, or everyone's going to know who I'm talking about in the audience. So you can't say, well, no one else takes offense, just that one guy. Well, yes, you are talking about that one guy. Okay. As opposed to where no one knows who I'm talking about, but this guy thinks I'm talking about him, let's just say, and he'll take offense. So it seems like in such a case, you don't necessarily have to be worried about that if the general audience is not going to take offense. Again, it wasn't clear. I don't recall which which work I saw this in and how far that would go, but it seems like he was entertaining the possibility that it's less of an issue. The second point is that I think that if you are not inherently saying something wrong, I'm not getting up and saying, okay, everyone, I'm about to say Lashon Hara. So if you don't want to hear Lashon Hara, leave the room. Well, you can't say Lashon Hara. I don't care who's in the room, right? So, you know, it's like the famous joke, which some of you may or may not be familiar with. In Yiddish, we say Nishtav Shabbos Geret, which means I can't talk about this on Shabbos, but. So you're not supposed to talk about business on Shabbos. So the famous joke goes, the guy comes to synagogue and says to his friend, I can't talk about this on Shabbos, but I'm looking to sell my car. And the other guy says, well, I can't talk about this on Shabbos, but how much are you asking? And this is a joke because people talk this way. They will say, I can't talk about this on Shabbos, but, okay. So that is not now I can say whatever I want. That Scott pointed out. I'm just joking when I say this. I don't mean to cause offense when I say this is not a heter. That's not a permission to just now go shoot off your mouth because you've preceded it with not to cause anyone offense, but. That's not okay. All right.
I was just going to say, Rabbi, I think, Dan, a great question, because I can remember listening to Rush Limbaugh, right? And Rush Limbaugh would, and I don't remember the words he would use, but sort of like you're entering, you know, you may be offended by what you're about to hear. John Caldera does it now for those of you that watch The Devil's Advocate or something, you know, that you're entering, you know, the devil zone, and really where it's just intentionally provocative kind of stuff. And look, I think trigger warnings actually are a pretty good thing. I do another time. I'm going to be doing a talk tomorrow night for History Colorado on extremism and the insurrection that were going on. And I give a trigger warning because I'm going to show some pretty graphic pictures of what happened on January the 6th. But I don't know that it gives me permission then to call people names.
Right. And I think therein lies the distinction, because to say this may cause offense and then say something that is inherently offensive, that is, you know, objectively offensive, is not okay. To give that warning and say something which is subjectively offensive, as you just said, with, you know, pictures of January 6th, that's not inherently offensive. Some people may be sensitive to it. Some people are not. So there, I think you're giving a warning. I would imagine, again, I didn't see a source for this, but logically it makes sense to me that because it's not my intent to offend, if it is my intent to offend, that's more problematic. But if it's not my intent to offend and it's not objectively offensive, it's more subjectively, if I'm giving a warning beforehand and saying this may be offensive to some people and those people have the option to leave or to not attend or to, you know, to move away, so then it's not a problem. Again, each situation is different. If I have a captive audience or people are going to be very awkward to walk out of the room, that may not be a fair thing to do. You know, if I say, what I'm about to say is offensive, some of you may want to leave and two people get up and leave, it's going to be very awkward for them. That may not be okay. But if before I give the talk, I say, if you are coming, just be aware there may be some things that could potentially be offensive. So then I would think that that's not a problem because I'm not trying to be offensive. The content is not inherently offensive. It's much more subjective. And I'm giving the people the opportunity not to be there. Okay, so Dan, I hope that somewhat answered your question in terms of that. So now I want to talk about limits. Okay, and this may be offensive for some people. Before I say this, so let me just show you over here. It's actually this week's parsha, Parshas Noach, when God tells Noach to take all the animals onto the ark. So the Torah says, so the Talmud says, one should not bring forth a shameful thing from his mouth. And maybe we have to have a separate class about speaking properly, not just about Lashon Hara, but about just how people talk in general. But that's not for tonight, just language-wise and words that get used that are not necessarily offensive to others, but are just inherently not nice words. And here's a great example. It says the Torah added 8 extra letters and did not bring forth a shameful thing from its mouth, as it says, from the animals that are pure and from the animals that are not pure. In Hebrew, the verse says, "Kol behema asher tahora v'asher einena tahora." Instead of saying from the animals that are pure and that are impure, the word in Hebrew is tame, it says from the animals that are einena tahora, that are not pure. Not pure is a more refined way of speaking than to say impure. Impure means unclean, dirty, okay? As opposed to saying not clean. Not clean is a nicer way of expressing something than to say dirty. Look how far this goes in terms of sensitivity of speech. It's incredible, okay? And that is a source actually from this week's parsha. So in terms of watching how one speaks in general, just how far one should go to say, you know, something is not clean instead of dirty, because dirty is a dirty word. So therefore, it is better to say an extra word, even though in order to avoid saying that. However, one of the commentators on that passage in the Talmud says like this. He notes that there is no shortage of places in the rest of the Torah where the word impure, tummy, is written. Okay, if you go through the book of Vayikra, Leviticus, where it talks about the laws of tuma, of ritual impurity, a carcass, a dead body, or the carcass of a dead animal, or someone who has saras, who has leprosy, and so on. The Torah uses the word tummy all the time. It uses the word impure all the time. So asks the Baal Ma'ar. Baal Ma'ar is Rabbi Zrachia Halevi, who was a great Spanish Talmudic commentator, lived, I believe, during the 1100s. He was famous for, he commented on Rabbi Alfasi's commentary on the Talmud. And then the Ramban, Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, then went and defended Rabbi Alfasi from the Baal Ma'ar's questions and challenges. Okay, so Rabbi Zrachia Levi's commentary is known as the Baal Ma'ar. They say he wrote it when he was 17. I don't know if it's true or not. It wasn't there. But that's what they say. So he wonders and he says, impure that is written elsewhere in the Torah is not shameful terminology. Why? Here he says a very important point. For the verse needs to warn the Jewish people and separate them from all impurity. Here's a very important point that he's making. When you need to make a point that something is impure, you need to say it as it is. You can't beat around the bush and use what we might call a more politically correct term. Okay, even though I know, Scott, you don't like that expression, but you can't look for the nicer way of expressing it. When you need to make a point, there's something wrong with this. You need to make that point. This is wrong. This is not okay. This is impure. When you need to make the point, you have to make the point, and you should not be beating around the bush. Sometimes it's very important to make yourself very clear. This is not okay. Not to use words that kind of convey your disapproval of something which is a problem. And so, again, making a judgment call when that is called for, it needs very careful thought and contemplation. But there are many situations where you have to stand up and instead of beating around the bush, as Scott said, you know, sometimes you just say ouch or oops to convey, but sometimes you have to really stand up and say, this is wrong. Again, one can abuse this idea and say, well, I decided this situation needed that. You have to use very careful judgment. Go back to our original source. You shall fear your God. You've got to be honest with yourself and know what your intentions are. Are you really trying to take a stand for the right reasons, or are you taking a stand for the wrong reasons? But the idea that sometimes you have to call something out for what it is very clear over here, which brings us to source number 10. Source number 10 concerning the prohibition of onoas dvarim, again, wronging with words, it is permitted to badger someone if it is in a fashion of rebuke. These prohibitions are permitted for a constructive purpose. And here, this is Kovetz Aris's Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, who actually lived pretty recently. He was murdered in 1941 by the Ukrainian Nazi collaborators. Fascinating story of his life. He came, actually was fundraising in America in 1939 as the clouds of war loomed large over Europe. And those in America begged him to stay because the writing was, people didn't realize what was really going to happen at that point, but the writing was somewhat on the wall. And he felt he had to go back because he had students. He had a community that was waiting for him. He went back to Europe and he was murdered 2 years later by the Ukrainian Nazi collaborators. But in any event, that's just a very brief, fascinating anecdote about his death. But Rabbi Wasserman makes the point that sometimes you do need to bat what he calls, you know, to badger someone, to bother someone, if you're doing it for a constructive purpose. Now, again, this is something which needs a lot of thought and contemplation. If you want to rebuke someone and you just go over and just, you know, like a bull in a china shop and tell them what you're doing is all wrong or something like that, you're not going to get very far. The Talmud says that already in Talmudic times, there were few, if any, people who knew how to properly give rebuke. That was true in Talmudic times. Okay. And so to be able to properly criticize someone else is a very fine art, very fine art. But again, the idea that sometimes you do have to speak up if someone else is engaged in bad behavior and they need to be told in no uncertain terms what you're doing is wrong and your intent is constructive and you've thought it through and you've been careful. And yes, maybe the person will take some offense, but they need to hear it. Sometimes people need to hear something that's offensive. So then it's not included in onas dvarim. It's not because you are doing it for a constructive purpose. And again, it needs very careful thought when it's appropriate to speak that way. But there are situations when it is appropriate. Okay. And I want to just make a point here for a moment. And that is that there are, and without getting involved in the politics and all the complications of modern society, but much has been made about what the Torah says and some ideas that are prevalent in modern society today. And that very often the ideas of modern society and what's, you know, okay to say and not okay to say, and what's okay to think or believe or act, very often comes to loggerheads with what traditional Torah thought says. Okay, again, I'm not getting involved in details and so on. And sometimes you have to be very careful how you express an idea from the Torah in terms of, am I going to offend someone? How can I say this without causing offense? And sometimes it's necessary to get up and say, XYZ is wrong. And even if modern society views it as not wrong, even if modern society views it as okay or even admirable, if the Torah says it's a problem, then it's not necessarily appropriate to avoid standing up and saying this is so a person has to stand up and say this is wrong. Now, again, where to say it, when it's appropriate to say it, how to say it needs forethought, needs contemplation. But there are situations where even though it might be offensive, There are situations where a person has to say, I'm sorry, but the Torah says this is wrong. And I'm sorry if you're offended, but the Torah says this is wrong to act this way, to live this way, and so on. And even if society thinks otherwise, even if you think otherwise, I apologize for that, but that's what the Torah says. And that's it. Okay. And again, you don't have to apologize for the Torah. You can apologize if the person's offended.
Can I make an important distinction? I think that what you're saying, though, you might disagree with me. But I think there's a big distinction between going out and telling that to a person or being asked what the Torah values are.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yes.
I think a lot of people make a mistake in personalizing their beliefs on other people versus being asked a sincere question of what the outlook is. I think that right off the bat changes the whole conversation in a positive way. If you're being asked something, you could say what you believe in a much more positive way. And I just want to make one other quick point on this point is that I do believe that there's a danger also if when we do say the Torah disagrees with modern values, it actually might be an embarrassment to the Torah. And that we have to be careful with too, that we shouldn't be coming out. It does, you know, promoting something that the world does not understand to be true and saying it in the name of Torah is a very tricky thing. It could cause us as Torah Jews to look negative. And that's not a plus for us or for the Torah. Again, but I still make the distinction between telling people the belief versus being asked, what does the Torah say?
Yeah. I think those are both good points. Just to add to Rabbi Haman's points, yes, what you've said is true. And that's, you know, like I said, there are situations where a person does have to say it like it is. Also, what it also means is that sometimes a person is maybe expected to toe a certain line in society because of the expectations of, you know, cooperating with the expectations from society. If that is going to cross a Torah line by cooperating with those societal expectations, that could be problematic as well. So, for example, if there's an expectation to express approval for a certain idea, which is at odds with Torah living, so then a person should not be expressing approval. The person does not have to come out and say loudly, the Torah does not approve of this, okay? But the person should not be expressing approval just because society expects him to, when the Torah does not approve of a particular idea or so on, okay? So I think that that's just important to understand that. And again, here's what we have, as Rabbi Haman pointed out, as I'm discussing, I think we understand how tricky it can be to balance what a person believes and what a person holds dear in terms of values and Torah values versus the need simultaneously to be sensitive to others. And very often it does require a great deal of forethought and contemplation. How can I do this in a way that I am staying true to my beliefs and to what the Torah expects of me, while simultaneously staying true to what the Torah expects of me to be sensitive to others? You know, the Torah expects that of me as well. And to be able to balance that often requires a great deal of thought. And at the end of the day, you know, one of the great unwritten commandments of the Torah is you've got to think, especially before you talk, you know, and so it goes back to that. Two more quick points, maybe not quick points, we'll see, I want to make before we take further comments. The question of, and again, this, I think Dan asked this from Scott, and I want to get to this. How far do you go in terms of sensitivity? That if any person gets up and says, well, I am offended by this or by that or by, and so on. If I walk into a room and someone says, well, your nose offends me, you know, or whatever it is, the way you dress offends me, do I then have to change my nose or my dress or, you know, my accent, whatever it is? That's obviously a very extreme example. Okay. If I express my approval of a particular divisive political figure, not because I'm expressing approval for his divisive policies per se, but because I happen to agree with certain other less divisive policies, less offensive policies. Is that considered an oz dvar? If I walk in and I say, I support, I don't know, some random politician whose policies are somewhat divisive without, no one knows who I'm talking about. You know, so, you know, is that a problem? Is that a problem? Does that mean, because does that make me, you know, racist, misogynist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or not? So, of course, you know, every case is unique and everyone can draw their own conclusions, but just a very fascinating source. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was asked, the great halachic decisor, and from the last, passed away in 1986, and he was regarded as the greatest halachic authority in America of his time. And he was asked the question as follows. A younger brother was ready to get engaged to a woman, and his older brother was still single. And in some Orthodox communities, you know, some have the custom that the younger siblings don't get married before the older siblings. And in some, that's not the custom per se, but the older sibling will be offended if the younger sibling gets married ahead of him, especially if they're of the same gender. Because you can understand, in a society where a great focus is placed on marriage, for the younger sibling to go first, it's kind of, the older sibling could take offense. And the question was, must the younger brother abstain from getting married in order to spare his brother that emotional pain? Rabbi Feinstein has a lengthy response. I'm pulling out, you know, one passage over here. And he said to him, this that you wish to say, that perhaps the younger brother must abstain from marriage because it is embarrassing for the older brother. He says, regarding the matter of embarrassment, it is only that he is embarrassment on his own from this. For there are many who delay getting married for many reasons. What Rabbi Feinstein is saying is over here, this is not inherently embarrassing. You are making yourself embarrassed about the situation. Very often people take offense because they think that the person speaking is speaking about them, or the person is saying something pretty innocuous, but it triggers something which they're sensitive about, or so on and so forth. And Rabbi Feinstein is making the point. If something is not inherently offensive or embarrassing, and this person is just working himself up about it, maybe he has reason to do so, but he's the one who's creating that sense of embarrassment because for whatever reason, and here he makes the point, there's no reason to be embarrassed, says Rabbi Feinstein, because your brother's going before you. It's quite common that an older sibling gets married. I'm sorry, that a younger sibling gets married before the older sibling. There are many who delay getting married for many reasons. So does it reflect badly on you, the older sibling, the older brother, because your younger brother's getting married first? No, you decided it reflects badly. You decided it's embarrassing. That's not the younger brother's problem. Now, how far you take this, again, we can fight over every single scenario in the world. But when all is said and done, there is certainly an idea of drawing a line between this is something which, yes, it makes sense, it could be offensive to someone, versus there's nothing offensive about this. You, whoever the person, the offended party is, are the one making a big deal about it. And again, where people get nervous, I think, in what Scott refers to, as cancel culture, is where people are making mountains out of molehills. Where there's nothing really offensive about what's happening, what's being said, but people are looking for things to get upset about. People are looking for reasons to be offended and things like that. And there you can certainly draw a line and say, there's nothing offensive about this. There are situations where it's very clear. There are situations where it's less clear. Okay. A good example, of where it's less clear, for example, the whole fracas over the picture I use in the flyer over the Dr. Seuss books. Okay. Again, we can talk about that quite a lot. And just one very brief example, the Mulberry Street book with the picture of the Oriental fellow, I looked at that picture and I said, how would I feel if it was a rabbi in that picture? Okay. Caricature that way. And I thought, I might well be offended by that. I can understand that. Some of the other claims against some of the other books, I was more skeptical. So where you draw that line of offensive versus you are looking for a problem, you are looking to be offended, that is something which, again, needs a lot of thought and contemplation, but certainly there is a line there. And lastly, just to conclude my presentation, what about penalties? What about penalties? So what society does, obviously we cannot control, but from a Torah viewpoint, there's an interesting halacha in Shulchan Aruch that's based on the Talmud, and it says, Bezdin, the Jewish court, which here in this context means when you have a Torah society that is governed by an overarching Bezdin, which kind of makes the rules and regulations within a community, and Bezdin in all places and eras must enact safeguards based on what they see, and some say that they excommunicate him until he appeases the embarrassed party. I'm leaving out a lot over here of what's going on, but it's talking about where one person is insulting another person with calling him names, very strong names like Mamzer or things like that, which for those who are not familiar, is a very strong pejorative term to call someone else. It's a very insulting name, or things like that, to call someone else a Mamzer or something like that is a very offensive term. And there are cases where Bezdin can levy penalties. If Bezdin sees in society there's a problem going on, that people are not being sensitive to others, and they're using language that is offensive to others, they can enact safeguards, and they can even excommunicate. Cancel culture. You can ostracize someone from the community if he is shooting off his mouth too much, if he's really being offensive to other people. Now, again, does that mean if someone made one comment that someone deemed offensive, that he should be ostracized, canceled, lose his job, and so on? Probably not. But the idea that a society has a responsibility to put safeguards into place to make sure that you don't just have people shooting off their mouths, saying whatever they want, despite the emotional damage it's causing to others, is here in this source. And again, where do you draw that line? Obviously, you're not going to excommunicate someone. You're not going to ostracize them just because of a minor faux pas. But if someone is being seriously offensive, the power does rest with a governmental body to put safeguards into place that people be careful with how they speak. And yes, this probably wouldn't sit well with a democratic society, where here you're saying that a government can actually put safeguards into place and curb what we might call free speech. But then again, Torah doesn't allow Lashon Hara either, which in society today is permitted based on the idea of free speech in society. So the Torah does demand that a Bezdin, that a Jewish government, put certain curbs on free speech into place, And this is another example of that. So that's what I have to say. If there are, Scott, any comments, final comments, or anyone else, please go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to just make two quick comments. First, I think there is a differentiation between politics, which it's fair game to argue with each other over, and political correctness. And I recognize there's a Venn diagram where these things intersect each other. But, that's the nature of a democracy, is to be able to argue about different ideologies and politics. The other was, I'm so glad you brought up the Dr. Seuss, because that was in the flyer that you cleverly put out there, and it was very provocative and good. Just to remind people, maybe it sort of was the heckler's veto that Dan talked about, but it was actually the Dr. Seuss Foundation, the Theodor Geisel Foundation, that evaluated and reviewed all of its books to make this determination. And I would only echo what you said about the Asian character, but also just the depiction of African Americans and Black people was pretty raw in those early era, the way that they were drawn. So that doesn't mean, despite the fact that you put a picture of the Cat in the Hat, I think, up or something like that, that one nobody had objected to.
I did hear some objections to the Cat in the Hat as being representative of different things and so on, and some of there was some talk about that, but I think that's where it kind of crosses the line between something that is clearly offensive to, let's see what we can dig up to be offended about, in terms of those things. Okay. If there anyone else?
I have a question on Dr. Seuss is not really my big tea cup of tea, I guess, but I mean, I know those books, but to me, I always wonder, I have a communication teacher in 11th grade who pointed out that Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn, that they used derogatory language when it was in the South. But the moment they moved north, this was his point, then they stopped. When the relationship changed between Huck and his friend, that changed. But to me, my question always is that in the history of that time, even though it's wrong at that point, that's what they know. That's what they saw. That's what they did. So is it a as big of an issue, or are we causing issue of the progress of what we've made by just kind of pushing that all away by canceling it? We've grown as a nation. Look, if I called you a derogatory name, I never did, but let's say, and then I realized what I'm wrong about, and
you're not speaking to me, right?
No, that we learned together for many years together. We used all of the Jewish religious names. Okay. That was just to sharpen each other's points, okay. But. That's the thing I struggle with. I struggle with the aspect of are we doing a disfavor to the history of the progress by just saying okay, this, tear down the Civil War, the war memorials, there was a lot of right or wrong in the year 2022 that in the year 2040, people are gonna look back and say, I can't believe people voted for this guy, or people voted for that guy, or thought this was okay. So I don't know what I'm asking really, besides the fact we kind of do this in a bubble of computers and.
I mean, if I can try to just express what you're saying,
please.
The bubble. I think there's a certain bubble in every generation where we stand of self-righteousness, that we have got it right and everyone else before us got it wrong. And then the next generation will come and say the same thing. And it's constantly evolving. And so we have to respect the previous generations, not of those who were evil and ignored objective realities of what was right and wrong, but things that were perhaps more subjective in terms of right and wrong. Even people like Abraham Lincoln are being, called into question in some circles because he wasn't quick enough on the Emancipation Proclamation, perhaps because of political considerations or whatever his beliefs were and so on. How far does one take that in terms of disavowing previous generations because our values today have evolved and again, you know, the word progressed, you know, comes up often in terms of that. Does that mean that George Washington was an evil person because he owned slaves in an era where that was par for the course? He wasn't necessarily supporting it and saying it was the most righteous thing to do. I believe he freed them in his will upon his death, you know. So as opposed to people who clearly were evil people and did not value, you know, the life of their slaves or so on and so forth, where they were in the wrong, versus people who were just going with what was the norm of those times. And yes, we've evolved and moved in a different direction. Does that mean that we disavow everyone of the past, which will just keep happening every generation as things move forward? Is that?
Yeah, one more point to it is, especially in the generation that we're so quick and so easy to, you know, be right and be like, we have so much access that we've never had to in the conversation. We have so much ability to find the mistake of the person in the past versus, you know, for 100 years after Lincoln, you basically, you know, had some, maybe some books and some research on it. Now, you know, you have every person access Googling it and coming up with these things. So that's my fear.
Can I make a comment? Rabbi Haman, I totally appreciate what you're saying. I have just a really recent experience that enlightened me a bit. I was in Charlottesville, Virginia this past weekend and went to Monticello, which was Thomas Jefferson's home. And it's beautiful. And there's a lot about Thomas Jefferson there. And he was an extraordinary American. And of course, he had several hundred slaves. And they told some of the stories, including that he flogged his slaves. You know, there was some real cruelty. And then, of course, there's the whole story about him having relations with a slave woman and children. And there was, first we visited the main part of the home, and then we got a tour of the slave quarters and more of the stories of the slaves. And I walked away thinking, first of all, I was trying to imagine the whole time, if I were African American, how I would feel on this tour. And during the Thomas Jefferson part, I think I would feel terrible. I think I would be very angry. And I was really appreciative that I got that they gave this, which they probably didn't do 5 or 10 years ago, this considerable tour of the life of the slaves. And I don't think it really reduces Thomas Jefferson's greatness to this country. And yet, I think if I were African American, I would have great problems with idolizing him or the recognition that he gets. It's a tough one.
So to your point, Dan, the fact that they embraced it versus, you know, canceled it is a much better route than this. That, you know, it's, and Scott wants to say something, I think.
I'm going to let Sue talk. The only thing I was going to point out, Rabbi, is, yeah, it only took 270 years to do that. So go ahead.
Yeah, but here's my point. Thomas Jefferson, if it wasn't for guys like Thomas Jefferson, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So they did good for their reality, for what they knew. We have the benefit of 200 years of evolving and intellectual and conversation and, frankly, comfort and freedom that wasn't there in those days. And it hasn't been for the – we have the most comfort and freedom we've had in the world ever, in the history of the time. Gives us a lot of ability to fix these problems, which is a blessing from God, you know, in a real way.
I'm going to let Sue talk, and then I'll ask.
So thank you. This has been really fascinating for me. So I'm happy that I was able to be here. I have a couple of thoughts. One is that for all of ADL's education programs, when we talk about how to respond to somebody that says something offensive, the first line is assume good intent and explain impact. And so I think that a lot of that in a lot of these examples that we're talking about in modern culture are missing, because I keep coming back, Rabbi, to your to your comment about self-righteousness. And I think that there is a corollary to the fact that so many people feel self-righteous. I'm always right, you're always wrong, and that's the default, is that we also don't have the same amount of respect for people whose views differ from ours. And when we have this sense of self-righteousness and a lack of respect, then this idea of assume good intent goes out the window. Because if I don't respect you, why would I ever think you had good intent? I'm just going to go for the jugular right away. And so, you know, in a setting where it's a personal thing, not these big, you know, political or societal or whatever, you know, giant things, but where, quite honestly, my observation, I think Scott would probably back me up, is that when we see these kinds of social, you know, real conflict, people's minds are made up before they ever get to whatever the thing is. Their minds are made up. They know they're right. They're not going to participate. They're not going to have a real dialogue. But when we have dialogues together, and I'm thinking about, you know, the two rabbis here who, you know, have a warm relationship because they are a chevruta, but a chevruta really also can be very adversarial over the text. It doesn't mean that they don't have respect for one another, and they know that they're not always right. They might try to prove their point. Scott and I go at it that way all the time as well, although not over Talmud, maybe over a point of, you know, what are we going to say in this letter? But that if you have respect for the people that whose views differ from you, then if someone says to you, you know, what you said was offensive, then it's not necessarily going to be on the defense to say, well, too bad. The response is going to be, oh, I'm sorry. Why, you know, because I care about you and I have respect for you. Why was that offensive? And maybe I can say it in a different way. And so that, I think that where I'm kind of going in my head with that aligns 110% with all of those Torah sources, that the Torah sources are all about not getting rid of conflict, because the world is full of conflict. That's not an achievable goal, but getting rid of cruelty and of purposeful offense to one another, which is not acceptable. It's not acceptable in our society. It's not acceptable. It's not an acceptable Torah value either.
You now know why I enjoy getting to work every day with Sue Parker Gerson.
You're right.
The only other thing I wanted to point out to Rabbi Haman was, yeah, sure, Jefferson was a product of his time, but John Adams knew that he didn't want to have slaves. George Washington freed his slaves on death. Thomas Jefferson did not free his slaves on death. I think that yes, their culture, their times were certainly different, maybe less evolved in thinking on all of this, but they were still enslaving other human beings. So you have to be careful. And I don't know the answer. You have to be careful on giving them a pass. Your point, and I don't remember which of the rabbis said this, you know, it's this whole thing about the Confederate statues. Do you get rid of them so that you forget the offense or try to erase the offense, or is it a good thing to keep it there? I'm kind of glad that on the Arch of Titus, it shows the Romans sacking, you know, Jerusalem at the time, because that's such an important pivotal part of our history. On the other hand, I jokingly say I was, my mother, my older brothers, my younger sister, they were all born in Denver. My parents moved away 2 years to the South. And so I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and came back to Denver at 10 months old. In order to remind me of this as a vestige, my middle name in English is Lee, after, you know, the general. I don't know. Should I? I was thinking about changing it, but Scott Levi Levin.
I was about to say, you know, switch genes.
That's right.
Levi.
That's right. But again, these are kind of important things.
I hear you, but Scott, to me, it's amazing. To me, that's amazing progress of the situation. To me, this, you know, but But I hear you, Scott. I just think that our struggle with owning slaves is completely not there. That's not the conversation of 200 years ago was where you could get away with something and you are within the context of your whole community, almost your whole people doing that. I'm not excusing it. I'm not giving a pass to it. I'm just saying is that I think that if we speak about it in those terms, we have a much better chance of taking it back onto what we struggle with in our times. And I think that's my main point. I think like Dan was saying, when you go to a tour about the song and you say, he was great and he has a struggle. Okay. Well, I can do great things. And I also could we have bad things that I've done in my life. I don't, you know, and we of course want to be his best and best, but we all ignore certain realities out there that we will have regrets for in 20, 30 years that we knew about. And you know how you knew about it? Because we had tea for teas about it. And the rabbi spoke about it on one side and we ignored him on the other side. So there are things. I mean, there's a lot of, a whole nother tea for tea topic about social media and all that stuff and how damaging that could be. Right. So we all might be using it and in 50 years could be condemned for using it and ignoring it. That's just my point. And that's what worrying at the moment. If we compare that apples to apples, what Thomas Jefferson's conversation was, then it's a fair conversation and then also a learning ability.
Ken Weil had a thought.
Yeah. Scott, I just wanted to ask you a follow-up question, which is there a distinction here about where we are placing these historical objects? And by that, I mean a monument in the center of town versus a museum that teaches the history. And as Daniel was talking about, Monticello is a museum and they have purposefully added, a slave tour and they've purposefully added exhibit about Henning so that they could be upfront about this very complex man. So is there a difference as to where we acknowledge this history?
I think it's a great point. I think Dan Adelman, your whole thing about Monticello, I think proves it. I mean, when you use these things as instruction and to help us to better understand, it's absolutely great. When you put them on the main street in Richmond, Virginia, where Black people have to pass by it and to be reminded of what their place in society is, then no, it's not acceptable.
I think, Ken, I was going to use that term as well. I'd say the difference to me between, let's say, a Jefferson or a Washington is the word I have heard. I enjoy listening to history podcasts, and whenever Jefferson's names come up, the word they always use about him is complex. He was a complex person. They don't really say Washington seems to have been a person who took a great deal of personal responsibility in his life, and for the country and so on. And they don't use that word complex about Washington. He had his flaws, to be sure, but it is a difference. And I think there is a difference between, let's say, going to a Monticello where there are complexities versus, let's say, going, I'll use the extreme here, and I don't want to cause offense, to going to, let's say, a place like an Auschwitz. There is nothing positive, in a Holocaust museum, there's nothing there that's saying, well, there was an upside and a downside. We're here to show you something which was completely holy and completely thoroughly evil versus an individual who accomplished great things, but simultaneously had serious character flaws, which affected a lot of people, And I think that's where a lot of the debate comes from. I think people get nervous. Columbus is another example. Do you want to rename every place that's named? Because he was cruel to the indigenous people over there. How do you reconcile that with, the brave explorer, who set off and discovered America and so on. So there is, I think, that struggle that people are struggling with. But what I get nervous is when it starts to go into people who should be much less controversial, people like a Lincoln, where there are people who are questioning, Lincoln as well, because he wasn't quick enough on emancipation or things like that. To me, that is a bridge, that I think is a bridge too far. That's my personal look on it. I don't have a problem with the Jefferson type thing, but you know, where you draw that line is where a lot of the discussion and where, frankly, people like me get nervous. You know, when it gets that far, like, 1 second, slow down. You know, if we're going to do that, so then the city of St. Louis has to rename itself. Because as far as I know, you know, St. Louis is named after the King St. Louis who burned the Talmud in the 1300s. If I'm not mistaken, he was made a saint afterwards. You know, there's even a yeshiva, or there was, called the Yeshiva of St. Louis, ironically enough. So I think it's the same person, not 100% sure. So, you know, again, putting the shoe on the other foot, you know, just in terms of from my Jewish perspective and Jewish history, you know, should we, like you said, should we tear down the Arch of Titus? Should we go to every church in Europe that was built that has, there's one of the famous, maybe it's the, I'm not sure which one, that has a, you know, the Jewish sow in front of it, you know, and when this whole thing came up, like, well, if you're tearing down Robert E. Lee, tear that down also, you know, so you have to kind of put the shoe on the other foot. Where do you cross the line between historical art or historical importance versus people's personal feelings? And I think a lot of, that's another, you know, debate, and we can keep going here all night. But those are just some of my final thoughts, not from the rabbi perspective, from the observer
Valerie's, perspective. Valerie's Santiana comment is right. I mean, we do.
Yes.
We have to remember our history.
Yeah. Thank you all. And God willing, next month we will have our next class. Take care. Have a wonderful evening.